two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalazavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families too have suffered as a result. They too have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
A sentiment echoed by other anti-apartheid campaigners here. Among them, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, who've called on the British government to refer Israel and Netanyahu to the International Court of Justice for war crimes in Palestine.
The protesters here are saying that the UK government's welcoming of Netanyahu is a mark of approval of his right-wing government, that it provides the Israeli regime with further cover to steal more Palestinian territory and to continue with its campaign of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people.
Earlier this week, the UK and Israel signed a so-called 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel relations, strengthening bilateral ties with the regime whose finance minister denies the existence of a Palestinian people.
This is an extreme right-wing government itself. So this is, you know, one proto-fascist government supporting a proper fascist government. So I don't feel that this government is ever representing me on other issues as well. But that they are supporting such an excessive, extreme right-wing government in Israel is a shame for all of us.
But while all eyes are on the intensified Israeli violence against Palestinians, others are highlighting another important reason that's dragged an embattled Netanyahu to Europe. His trip comes in the wake of the recent Chinese-brokered rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu could be here to gauge European government's position on Iran. From London, the Israeli PM will be flying to Berlin, Germany, where he's expected to be greeted with similar protests. Said Puriza, London. A day after a surprise jump in inflation, an expected rise in the Bank of England's interest rate from 4% to 4.25, the 11th increase in less than 2 years.
The Bank of England argues the increase in the interest rate is aimed at reducing inflation that's amongst the highest levels since 1982. On the other hand, there are some economists who are saying it'll inevitably increase the pressure on many Britons, already being squeezed by the cost of living crisis.
That's because a higher interest rate means a higher cost of borrowing.
It's going to affect people with mortgages, and it's going to affect companies with debt, and there's a lot of companies with a lot of debt.
Today's interest hike comes against the backdrop of this pledge by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in January.
We will halve inflation this year to ease the cost of living and give people financial security.
that is yet to happen. Some economists say some of the inflation rise can be blamed on potentially one-off factors, such as vegetable shortages caused by extreme weather in Spain and North Africa, and British producers not producing for fear of massive energy bills. Others say there are other underlying reasons. The Bank of England was the first to increase interest rates, but not the only one. EU and US central banks have also raised borrowing costs, with the American Central Bank's chair, Jerome Powell, saying there was still a long way to go to tame inflation in the world's largest economy. While Britons continue to contend with the soaring cost of food and energy, would this be the last rate hike by the UK's central bank? Syed Purizza, London.
Turkey's pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party and its allies have announced that they will not field a candidate to run against President Erdogan on May 14. HDP co-chairwoman Pervin Buldan made the announcement in a presser for the Labour and Freedom Alliance, which includes the HDP, the Turkish Workers' Party and other leftist parties. Although it was not made clear during the conference, the announcement means the HDP will support the opposition National Alliance candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
We will fulfill our historical responsibility against the one-man rule. We are determined to hold this government, which continues a rule based on poverty and corruption. The HDP and its allies will not nominate a candidate for May 14.
The announcement is considered a major setback for Turkish President Erdogan, as the HDP is the third largest party in parliament. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan slammed the opposition bloc's cooperation with the pro-PKK People's Democratic Party, saying alliances should focus on common principles rather than negotiations over seats.
The announcement by the Kurdish alliance that they will not nominate a candidate will make this election difficult for President Erdogan, which means that the Kurdish votes will go to Kılıçdaroğlu. Yesterday, we also heard President Erdogan say that 17 of his ministers and his deputy will run for parliamentary elections to strengthen his party's position in these elections. Erdogan knows his position is not the strongest after the Kurdish alliance announcement and is trying to fix things around him to make sure he wins.
On Tuesday, the day before the announcement, Kılıçdaroğlu met with HDP leadership in the parliament building in Ankara, during which he made promises to remove restrictions on the Kurdish language and address other related issues. The May 14 election looks to be a tough one for the ruling party and its allies. Many say Kurdish voters could play the role of a kingmaker and help the opposition win this time. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major disputes with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
The nation following his re-election.
This is in line with historical logic because we are each other's largest neighboring powers. We are also all-round strategic partners.
This is the 40th meeting between Putin and Xi during their presidency, which indicates the high and close level of cooperation between China and Russia for a long time. President Xi arrived in Moscow on March 24, for a three-day visit. He began his visit with an informal meeting with Vladimir Putin, which lasted almost 5 hours. On Tuesday, the head of state held an official meeting at the Grand Kremlin Palace. The priority in relations between Russia and China is trade and economic cooperation. In the documents signed by the two leaders, they vowed to multiply the volume of trade. It is expected that the Russian Federation and China will exceed the historical record trade volume of $200 billion this year. On February 24th, on the anniversary of the start of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Chinese Foreign Ministry presented a 12-point plan to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
We believe that many of the provisions of the peace plan put forward by China are consonant with Russian approaches and can be taken as the basis for a peaceful settlement when they are ready for it in the West and in Kiev. However, so far we have not observed such readiness on their part.
China and Russia, as permanent members of the UN Security Council, also vowed to uphold the fundamental norms of international relations and build up constructive force for the formation of a multipolar world.
As for sending military equipment and weapons, military cooperation, China is unlikely to take drastic steps. First of all, China acts based on its own interests, not forgetting that relations with the Western world do not become bad. Otherwise, China itself faces sanctions. Its main trading partners are still in the West.
Putin and Xi Jinping also signed two joint documents setting long-term goals until 2030 across all tracks, a statement on plans for economic cooperation and a statement on plans to deepen partnership.
The Chinese president's three-day visit to Russia demonstrates the close historical relations between Beijing and Moscow. Any agreement made during Xi's trip can be regarded as a milestone given the fact that a new world order is being shaped. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Black community leaders demanding immediate action to reform Britain's largest police force, coinciding with an official report into the Metropolitan Police by victims' rights and social welfare expert. It was exactly that failure that prompted the report. In March 2021, Wayne Cousins, a serving Metropolitan Police officer, abducted, tortured, raped, and killed Sarah Everard. Cousins was jailed for life. His conviction prompted another woman to come forward, accusing another officer, David Carrick, convicted of raping 12 victims over 17 years. Police Commissioner Mark Rowley has welcomed the report, but stopped short of admitting the force he leads is institutionally racist.
We have racist, misogynist, and homophobes in the organization, and it's not just about individuals. We have systemic failings, management failings, and cultural failings. The reason, and I respect Louise using that term, the reason I don't use it, I think it's a very ambiguous term.
On the whole, the report is condemning of this big organization, pointing to the fact that it has lost public confidence and consent, and that it has to wake up, own up to the problems plaguing it, and engage in wholesale across-the-board reforms.
Black community leaders, though, say they're concerned the reform may not go far enough.
This is just another report saying the same thing that's been said for decades now in this here country. The Metropolitan Police is institutionally racist. Policing is harmful. It's misogynistic. It is homophobic. And for me, as a black woman, the police, the Met Police, is an anti-black organization, anti-black racism organization.
In February, the charity inquest found that black people are 7 times more likely than white people.
Black people are 5 times more likely to be tasered than white people. You could go on and on and on.
The report is a wake-up call for the Metropolitan Police. Its author, as do these minority community leaders, says her recommendations are not to be picked from, but to be implemented. Without them, she says, the force may need to be disbanded. Saeed Purizza, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Netanyahu blinks as pressure intensifies. Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agrees to delay the overhaul to the judiciary that his right-wing government wanted to push through. After 12 weeks of intensifying protests, the regime's security minister announced that the government would delay trying to implement the change. Tens of thousands of protesters have shown up to condemn the proposed judiciary changes. And the divide is growing as the regime is on the edge of imploding. Well, stay with us as we take a look at this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator at Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver. And Mukhaimar Abu Saida, Professor of Political Science, Al-Azhar University, Gaza City. Welcome both of you to the program.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to start off with Mukhaimar. Thanks so much for being with us. Looking at the situation, the judiciary reforms have now been delayed for now. How fearful do you think the government is overall of what has taken place of these growing protests?
What happened in Israel over the past 3 weeks is unprecedented. Let me say that for the first time, probably, the Israeli society is so deeply divided over these judicial reforms between the protesters who are protesting against the judicial overhaul and the right-wing coalition who are supporting such reforms. And as the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has indicated this evening in his speech, he said he decided to delay or suspend those judicial overhaul because he wanted to avoid civil war within the Israeli society. Now, we have heard such language first from the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, 2 or 3 weeks ago when he warned against a civil war inside Israel. And now the prime minister this evening, Netanyahu, he decided to postpone or delay those judicial reforms because he is afraid that the Israeli society is drifting into a civil war. Let me also add that he accused a radical leftist group in the Israeli society that they are pushing for civil war and they are pushing for this instability. But overall, I believe that the prime minister and his coalition government came out of this fiasco, so to speak, a very injured government or a very fragile government. The government or the right-wing coalition led by Netanyahu could not stand against the opposition, against the protesters who have been taken into the streets of Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Haifa, and many other Israeli cities against the government and against the judicial reforms. Yes, Netanyahu has decided to suspend those reforms for the next Knesset session in a few months, but the opposition leaders, Yair Lapid, who is the head of the Israeli party, Yesh Atid, decided that if the government decides again to go with these judicial reforms in the future, the streets and the opposition will be ready again to mobilize against the government and the current coalition.
Well, staying with you, Mohammed, what you just said, they have said that if in the next session they continue to go after these reforms and the people will go out on the streets again, do you think that that means that right now the protests will stop? Because actually what is being said by Netanyahu and by some of his cabinet members is that it has been delayed just for now and will be picked up right after their Passover holidays. So do you think that these protests are going to continue, or do you think that they're going to be basically suspended also right now?
To the best of my knowledge, the speech by the president in which he agreed to delay those judicial reforms has diffused the crisis for the time being. Mm-hmm. And I believe that even though that many Israeli institutions like the Israeli airports and Israeli ports and the Israeli General Trade Union, the Israeli health system, many institutions in Israel were ready to go on strike starting from tomorrow. But I think as a result of the speech by Netanyahu this evening, Israel will go on business as usual from tomorrow. And the crisis has been, as I mentioned, to the best of my knowledge, has been diffused for the time being. But it will be diffused for a few months until the next Israeli Knesset session, because Netanyahu said that there will be dialogue between now and the next Israeli Knesset session. Now, if the opposition and the current coalition reaches some kind of a compromise, that would probably put an end to this internal crisis for a long time. But if the opposition and the coalition do not reach a compromise between now and the next Knesset session, Israel might find itself again in a situation like the one we have seen over the past 3 months. But the protests that took place yesterday and today after Prime Minister ousted his Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, I think the streets of Israel were full of anger against the prime minister and against his coalition, because many Israelis believe that the minister of the army, Yoav Gallant, was at least the most acceptable person within the coalition of Netanyahu and his right-wing ministers.
Okay. Well, Charlotte, let me get you in on this conversation. I mean, your perspective, how dangerous is this divide in general to the regime? As Mohammed said, it seems for now that the situation perhaps is calming down. But Netanyahu says that, of course, he will definitely, after the Passover holidays, that actually try to get this up and running again as far as the changes in the judiciary. I want to look at, in general, how dangerous do you think the divide is inside of this regime right now?
Well, right now, the Divide is mostly focusing on how best to accomplish the Zionist goal of the colonization of Palestine and maintaining a form of hegemony over the region in mm-hmm. league with U.S. and European imperialism. So rather than being about the nature of the state itself, which is actually revealed through this process, it's about how best to conduct this form of repression, how best to conduct this form of colonization and racism and settler colonialism. At the same time, the fact is that this is inducing divisions within the security establishment. We already saw Palestinian prisoners consciously seize the opportunity in order to obtain a victory over the fascist attacks by Ben-Gvir, not because the prison's authority is any kind of is anything other than an enemy of the Palestinian people, but because this is preoccupying the Zionist regime, including its army, including its security forces, and that does portend a weakening and a fundamental insecurity about the future of the settler colonial project in the region.
Well, staying with you, actually, Charlotte, I mean, since the creation of the regime, all Israeli governments have been extreme for Palestinians. And however, this one has been seen as more extreme for the Israelis themselves. Do you think that part of this in general is because of the overall impunity that Israel enjoys from so many of these Western countries in the world that not only have they gotten more extreme with Palestinians, but even the arrogance that how they deal with each other. Do you see an effect of the overall effect of that impunity on the way this entity carries itself?
Well, it's absolutely happening on multiple levels, because what we've seen time and time again is that no matter what these settler paramilitaries do in terms of killing Palestinians, seizing land, demolishing homes, no matter what massacres take place, what continues to happen is that the imperialist backers of the Zionist regime continue to apologize for it, protect it, and ensure that it is not prosecuted in any international arena for its ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so certainly what that's done also is strengthen the most fascist forces within an already racist settler colonial and indeed fascist regime in many ways, because it's clear that there is no accountability and no punishment, whether that's against Netanyahu for his ongoing corruption or whether that's against the entire ruling class across the board in the Zionist project. I mean, right now there's a debate over the resignation of the defense minister, the war minister, the person who's responsible for these ongoing war crimes. So there's a complete impunity across the board, and certainly that only encourages the formation and construction of settler paramilitaries, which even go beyond the direct control of the Zionist state in terms of the struggle over the future of Zionism.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
The majority of Jews in Israel are reportedly secular, but that's not the reality, of course, in the makeup of this current government. Do you see that this is starting to play a more divisive role overall in the Zionist entity, or your assessment of that? How is that affecting it?
Well, dear Marzia, the Israeli society used to be a very secular society right at the establishment of Israel back in 1948 and all the way until the end of 1970s. Mm-hmm. But let me remind you and remind your viewers that beginning of the early 1980s, Israel started to drift into the right The first right-wing government in Israel was formed in 1977 when the Likud, for the first time in the history of Israel, won the Israeli elections and formed a right-wing Israeli government in 1977. And Israel drifted more and more toward the right wing right after the start of the Palestinian Second Intifada in the year of 2000, because many, many Israelis at that time blamed the Labor government and the left and center left in Israel, where they were accused of in Israel that they were responsible for the eruption of the Second Intifada, which was a very violent intifada in which more than 1,000 Israelis were killed in bombings by the Palestinians. So ever since the start of or the eruption of the Palestinian Second Intifada, for the past 20 years, the Israeli society drifted more and more into the right and radical right. And as we have seen in this current coalition government, for the first time, we are witnessing not just a radical or a right-wing Israeli government. We are watching for the first time fascist and extreme right and ultra-religious parties who are making this current Israeli coalition. For the first time, we have seen ministers like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich who are calling for the for ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. Smotrich, who is the Minister of Finance and a minister in the Ministry of Army, has called up for the wiping out of a Palestinian village, Hawara, in which a Palestinian fighter came out on February 26 and killed two Israeli settlers. Mm-hmm. Smotrich also, in Paris, just about a week ago, he spoke that the Palestinian people is an invention, that there is no Palestinian people. So we are witnessing more and more radical sentiments from radical Israeli ministers, radical Israeli members of the Knesset, which is unheard of in Israel. And as I just mentioned to you, Israel used to be more of a secular country, but it's not the case anymore now.
Okay. Well, Charlotte, I mean, as we were talking about the Israelis turning out by tens of thousands protesting what they deemed as extremist right-wing government. I mean, why is it that we never see massive protests from these same individuals condemning the continual murder and theft of land of the Palestinians? I mean, these people, if we look at mainstream media, they show that these are democratic marches, a fight for democracy in Israel, trying to show that this is a more open-minded group of people, the masses. But in the reality, we don't see these type of protests ever. We recently saw 9 Palestinians killed in one day. We see continually their homes being destroyed, and so much abuse on a daily basis. Why is that the case?
Well, as we were noting, these protests are not about democracy in the true sense of the term. They are not about justice. They are not about human rights. What they are about is about the future of Zionism and how best to preserve the security of the Zionist project. And many sectors of the Zionist project, including part of the military and security elite, are convinced that the path of Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, and Smotrich has given too much power to uncontrollable settlers and too much power to uncontrollable individual politicians, to the detriment of the overall Zionist project and its colonization of Palestine. And so that's why we also don't see the mass participation of Palestinians in Occupy Palestine 48 or their political forces, which are not even welcome in these protests, the symbol of which is the Zionist flag, the very symbol of colonization, apartheid and racism in occupied Palestine from the river to the sea. So this is about how best to secure the colonization of Palestine from the river to the sea, not about liberating Palestine from the river to the sea. And that's the difference between Zionist protesters and the Palestinian resistance, who are the people who are on the front lines and actually fighting for real democracy and real justice in this land from the river to the sea.
Right. Well, picking up on what Charlotte said, Mohammed, when we look at, though, how especially, again, I'll look at corporate media and how they've been showing these protests on the one hand, that these are these liberal and open-minded people fighting against these extremists. At the same time, we see those same governments, those Western governments, once again not condemning what is happening on a day-to-day basis to Palestinians, basically being silent as every day, practically, we're seeing more and more Palestinians being killed. I want to look at the role of these Western governments, even in the way that these demonstrations are being portrayed in the mass media and the overall effect.
Well, Marzia, yeah, I totally agree with you that when it comes to the Western society, we haven't seen real condemnation against Israeli aggression against the Palestinian for the past 75 years. And the minute that the Israeli society started to drift into so-called civil war, many Western governments started to state that they are very concerned and very unhappy about what is happening internally in Israel. The U.S. Administration, Western governments like Britain, Germany, and others have expressed their unhappiness about what is happening in Israel, and they were very much concerned that that might affect the security of Israel. Now, when it comes to the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people, yeah, I agree with you, and I agree with Charlotte. What we are witnessing is that the Western governments are trying to preserve the Israeli colonial enterprise to keep its hegemon over the Palestinians and in the region. And we know that the international community is playing with double standards when it comes to the Palestinian people. Unfortunately, they don't really care much about the killing of the Palestinian. Let me just add one little note here is that since the beginning of this year, 2023, more than 80 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli army and Israeli special forces. And Israel even has continued in its aggression against the Palestinians by expanding settlement units in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and house demolition against the Palestinians. Tens of the Palestinians have also been arrested by the Israeli regime. You name it. Many Israeli practices have been taken by this current Israeli government. And unfortunately, we haven't really heard serious condemnation of these acts by the Israeli government from the U.S. or from Western European countries. And as I just mentioned to you, unfortunately, this double standard by the Western community or Western countries have been very much noticed by the Palestinians, by many countries in the region. And it seems to me that Western hypocrisy is at its zenith at this moment, when we witness how these Western government are very much concerned for what is happening inside Israel, and they don't really care much about what happens for the Palestinian people who have been suffering from expulsion and from occupation for 75 years now, since the establishment of Israel in 1948.
Yeah, very good points, Mohammed, because it seems like they've put so much time and emphasis in showing these demonstrations and at the same time basically ignoring the day-to-day suffering of the Palestinians. Thank you both so much for being with me. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, out of Vancouver, and out of Gaza City, Mohammed Abu Saada, Professor of Political Science, Al-Azhar University. And thank you for being with us on another program. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
The British government has put very strict laws against asylum seekers on its agenda, and despite criticisms and violations of international law, it has announced that it is determined to implement these laws. For example, the British government, which claims to champion human rights, intends to transfer refugees from hotels to military bases in order to save money and discourage those who intend to immigrate to the country. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. The British government is locked in negotiations with up to 60 Conservative lawmakers trying to ban the European Court of Human Rights from interfering with Britain's controversial immigration policy. Home Secretary Suella Braverman said she was in talks with up to 60 Conservative MPs who want to stop Britain from following decisions made by the court in Strasbourg. If ministers agree to block the use of a mechanism used by the European Court of Human Rights, migrants who arrive in the United Kingdom illegally could be deported even if they challenge the government under human rights law. The plan comes ahead of a major rebellion from both wings of the Conservative Party over Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's illegal migration bill, which will stop people crossing the channel in small boats. Rishi Sunak has promised to end the small boats issue once and for all by introducing the bill. Critics, including former Tory ministers, said the measure is doomed to be halted by challengers in the European Courts of Human Rights and will be used as an issue to attack Labour in a general election campaign. Conservative ministers have warned the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, that decisions by the Strasbourg court would make Britain an international pariah. Last year, the court granted an injunction that effectively grounded a flight sending asylum seekers from Britain to Rwanda. On her recent trip to Rwanda, Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary, said she was encouraged by constructive talks with Strasbourg to overhaul court injunctions. London's policy of deporting illegal migrants to Rwanda is currently on hold, while it is challenged separately in British courts of law. The case is awaiting a hearing at the Court of Appeal after judges granted an appeal to the High Court's original decision that the policy was lawful. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Children's social services bosses launched an outspoken attack on the British government's illegal migration bill, warning it could lead to thousands of youngsters in care running away into the arms of human traffickers and criminals. The Association of Directors of Children's Services in England said the proposed legislation undermined existing laws that protect children and contradicted the government's own vision for children in care. Stable homes built on love, outlined recently. Steve Crocker, the president of the Association of Directors of Children's Services, said, "If implemented, the bill will irreversibly distort the care system. The care system is not, nor should it be, a holding mechanism for the immigration system. When a child first comes into our care, our primary focus is to find them a permanent, stable home, as set out in the statute. We cannot carry out this essential work if they are to be removed as soon as they turn 18 years old, despite having care, leaving rights and entitlements up to 25 years. Stating that all children in this country, irrespective of where they are born, have the right to a safe and nurturing environment," Steve Crocker said. the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child states that all actions concerning children, the best interests of the child, shall be the primary consideration. Sadly, this bill is a clear step away from over 30 years of custom and practice in this country. The bill proposes to detain and deport asylum seekers who arrived in the United Kingdom by irregular means, in small boats, or in the back of lorries. Unaccompanied children will be deported when they turn 18 years old. The Refugee Council estimates 40,000 children will be affected in the first 3 years if the bill becomes law. The Association of Directors of Children's Services announced a statement reflected the serious concerns of local authority children's services heads about the damaging effect of the bill would have on children who had arrived in the United Kingdom having fled desperate situations. This cohort of migrant children would in effect become part of a two-tier care system in which they had fewer care rights than their contemporaries. Steve Crocker said it was likely to create an incentive for children to run away before they turn 18, into the arms of exploiters and traffickers to avoid being returned to their home country of origin. Steve Crocker added, "The lack of permanency would create unintended safeguarding risks for unaccompanied minors in local authority care and children who are detained with their family in Home Office accommodation for whom it was not clear where safeguarding responsibilities lay." Steve Crocker stressed the bill ran counter to the government's own vision for children in care, set out with great fanfare in February in its response to the Independent Review of Children's Care. British newspaper The Independent has also covered this story and tells us more. A report has revealed the British government plans to move asylum seekers from hotels to military bases or disused ferries under plans that could be announced as early as next week. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is expected to announce the beginning of the end of asylum hotels, which are currently being used to house asylum seekers as part of the government's legal obligation to provide people seeking help with a basic level of accommodation. The report said more than 50,000 migrants are currently housed at a cost of nearly £7 million a day in hotels. Under the new proposal, migrants will initially be moved into decent but rudimentary accommodation in former military bases, which will be used to house single adult male migrants. Ministers are also understood to be seeking to use disused ferries, but plans to use student accommodation and holiday camps have been put on hold. The idea of using ferries was suggested back in November when the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, told officials to find sites that could accommodate asylum seekers and to consider disused cruise ships as well. The decision to move out the asylum seekers from hotels comes after the British government announced its new illegal migration bill, upon which people entering the United Kingdom on small boats will be detained immediately and hindered from claiming asylum in the United Kingdom. The plan also bans immigrants from returning once removed. Prior to this, asylum seekers had the right to remain in the country to have their cases heard. Home Office figures showed that around 3,000 migrants have crossed the Channel already this year, compared with a record of 45,000 Channel crossings during the whole period of 2022, surpassing the previous year's record by more than 60%. The government's plan is consisted of different policies designed to stop asylum seekers arriving in small boats, including a deal with Albania to return arrivals to their home country, and the police to send home asylum seekers to Rwanda. However, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak came under fierce criticism by the United Nations Refugee Agency for extinguishing the right to seek refuge protection in the United Kingdom.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.